We welcome Peter with us. He's a seminarian studying for the Diocese of Charlotte. Is that correct? Okay. And he's just entering First Theology. He's doing his theologate at Mount St. Mary's in Cincinnati. Am I also right about that? Yes. Okay, good. So we wish you all the best in your studies. And he's here visiting his aunt and uncle are Bob and Kathy Smith. My condolences on, I'm just kidding. we're happy to have you with us. Also, you might notice that we are running on empty when it comes to deacons this weekend. They have been on their retreat this whole weekend, so they should be wrapping that up shortly. But maybe we could say a little prayer in our hearts that they will have received all the blessings necessary to continue to be blessings to us, priests and faithful. This parable is one that I think most of us are pretty intimately familiar with, right? The story of Lazarus and the rich man and all of that. Now, we could oversimplify this at first reading and say, well, this is the moral of the story here is that karma is going to get you. But we don't believe in karma. That's a pagan notion. It's not right. There is no such thing as karma. However, what's the point here then? Well, the point is that I think when it comes right down to it, Jesus is most concerned about those who insulate themselves from the sufferings and the needs of others, or even for that matter, themselves. I think in our modern age is very good at running away from problems. In fact, it's all centered around that. You know, it's the dramatic news stories, especially those that demonize the other guys, right? It's their fault. It's their fault. Well, let's transfer any focus away from what it is that might be going on with me. It's an all too human sort of instinct to deflect away from what is painful to us or what is painful to look at in ourselves. But also, it's painful to look at the plight of others. And so, very often, we will find ourselves walling off from the legitimate sufferings of other people. And forgive me if I've told you this, but I had family that I've been friends with for pretty much most of my priesthood, and they had a daughter, their oldest daughter, who ended up going on a family vacation, and they went to Jamaica. You know, they did the whole thing, and they were at this resort, and it was so nice, but they had to load people up in buses and take them to a different portion of the city. I think they were in Kingston, and all the buses had curtains over the windows, and so she couldn't see outside, but her, being a curious kid, pulled the curtains aside and saw that they were driving through slums that were in between the two parts of the resort. And she was just inconsolable after that. Like, she didn't want to do anything anymore. She just kind of sulked until they went home, because she saw just the dramatic difference between the way they were living and the way those people were living. And it just broke her heart. And I think that's the key here, right? When we are confronted with the needs of the poor, and that can be the materially poor, that can be the spiritually poor, that can be those who are poor in terms of their sense of their own dignity or their relationship with God, which gives us dignity, then it should break our hearts. But in having our hearts broken, then we allow God's grace to come in, and we also allow God's grace to flow out from our hearts. I want to look at this story here in Luke today. Jesus tells almost endless parables, these little stories, these little contrived stories, to try to illustrate theological concepts, to try to tell them about God the Father, to try to tell them about the realities of heaven and hell, to try to tell them how they are to be and who he is and how what we're supposed to be in relation to him. And many of his stories are very colorful, and he comes up with these elaborate situations as he explains these mysteries through these stories. And then there's this parable, which I personally believe is not actually a parable. Why do I say that? There's a stark difference. There's one word that is of stark difference in contrast between this parable, quote parable, and the rest of the parables of Jesus. Can you guess what it is? One of the characters is named. Is that Lazarus? One of the characters in the story has a name. None of the other parables of Jesus mention anybody in particular. They just kind of frame the situation and they make up this story, right? You know, the Good Samaritan, not a real guy, part of a story to illustrate a point. I think Lazarus was a real guy. And I think the rich man was a real guy. And I think that Jesus, in talking to the Pharisees and telling them this story, is not telling them a story that he just made up. He's telling them a story that each one of them probably knows personally. One little detail that I noticed in this reading, it says, there was a rich man who dressed in purple garments and fine linen. That's the kind of stuff that the temple priests were told in the law of Moses to wear when they offered sacrifice in the temple. So, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that not only was this man a real man and a rich man and known by the Pharisees, I think he might have been one of the temple priests. Now, I know I'm going out on a limb here. I'm being a little bit speculative because we don't know those things, but there are just certain details about this that are so different than his other stories, that I think that he's speaking of someone that they know. And I think it's also telling that he gives the name of the poor man, which they probably never bothered to learn, and doesn't give the name of the rich man, whom they probably knew well. They were probably friends with him, or at least knew of him. And he tells the story in such a way that they would have to know who this guy is, because they would have to know who this poor man is. This guy sitting outside a rich man's house, and he had sores all over him, the dogs and the whole thing, right? Told the story in such a way that they could not but know who it was. And then he spells out what happened to them. And this is even more surprising and more subversive, because if you also look at the law of Moses and some of the codes of ritual impurity, if anybody exuded any kind of unexpected bodily fluids, they were determined to be rendered ritually impure, which means they could not go to the synagogue, they could not go to the temple to offer sacrifice. They had to go through, first they had to heal, then they had to go through a period of cleansing, and then they could be... Once the priests had looked at them and said, okay, you're good to come in, then they could come in. Otherwise, they couldn't. And then you have a dog, an unclean animal, just a scavenger. They weren't pets back then. They were not sentimental about pets, right? They were street sweepers' dogs. They were there to clean up all the stuff that was left over in the streets after they closed up their shops and their bazaars and all of that. They were the scavengers. And so here's this scavenger going up and licking this guy too. It's this unclean animal licking this unclean man, ritually speaking. And he's the one that finds himself at the bosom of Abraham. Whereas the other man, well, he lost out, the rich man. Why? Because he failed to see what was right in front of his eyes. He failed to see the suffering of this other person. And he failed to do anything out of his considerable means to alleviate that situation. He doesn't even step out of this selfish doldrum that he's in until he starts experiencing the torment of the next life. And he starts to say, oh, wait a minute. Well, I have family. He finally remembers his family, his brothers. Please warn them so they don't come here too. So he's finally getting outside of his selfishness at least a little bit. But prior to that, I mean, he's even saying, he's seeing Lazarus up there, with Abraham, and he's like, hey, send your toady over to me. Send Lazarus over to me. You know, he's still got that mentality of the world revolves around me. He still can't see it. Finally he gets it, sort of. You know, this reminds me of really kind of some of the essence of the church's social teaching, especially when it comes to how to respond to the needs of the poor. Been a lot of ink spilled over that issue. And I think in today's day and age, you know, we tend to have this attitude of, well, you know, we have all these social programs and we have all these, this thing and that thing and, you know, welfare and all of that. And I'm not going to say that there aren't some of those things that are absolutely helpful and maybe even required in some sense of government. But I want to spell out something, though, that once again, one of the operative principles of the church's social teaching is the principle of subsidiarity, which says that those things that can be handled at the lowest level of society should be handled at the lowest levels of society. They should be. And there's a reason for that. It's because whenever you are handling things in the smallest unit, which is maybe between persons or within the realm of a family unit or within the realm of a community, you are addressing needs to people. You are looking at people. But whenever you go to the highest level and you do all the work up there, then what you are dealing with then, or at least from our perspective, is not people, but numbers and statistics. Human beings are far more than numbers and statistics. It is far too easy to, like the rich man, insulate ourselves from the realities of the sufferings of other people if we are not eyeball to eyeball with them. And I will tell you that as a priest, of course, what a wonderful thing that people who are in need will come to a priest because they apprehend that that's the place to come when you're in need. That actually does my heart good. It actually does my heart good. Sometimes people are, trying to play a system, whatever. Okay, fine. But whenever I see people with real poverty in front of me, it breaks my heart, as I said earlier, right? And I may not be able to alleviate everybody's suffering. You all that work with the St. Vincent de Paul Society, those of you who are involved in Gabriel Project, thank you, by the way. And I think you would probably, any of you that are involved in that, would stand up and say, it is its own reward. Thank you for letting me do it. That's what I hear over and over again from people. And that kind of thing is my experience in those sorts of situations. But when we are able to give of ourselves, even if we're not able to solve their problem, we are humanized by that. We apprehend something human. We are built up, and we're accruing merit for eternal life, to tie it back to Jesus' story today. And what's happening with the other person? Well, I would hope that they are seeing some other human being who is looking at them as a human being and saying, you are worth my time and you are worth at least some of my resources. That is dignifying to them. It is humanizing. It is humanizing. Now, once again, there is a definite case for stuff to happen at the higher levels or in depending on certain government programs and what have you. I'll give you an example of one that's probably going to be necessary really quick, and that is the hurricane that's roaring up through the Gulf of Mexico right now. I don't know if it's yet a hurricane, but it will become one. Could we just simply stand back and say, well, you know, hey, subsidiarity, you know, those communities there, you know, they can handle that. What are the chances, do you think, that those individual communities that will, wherever they may be, get hit by that hurricane are going to be able to just deal with it themselves, with their own resources? Nil. Nor would we if it happened to us, right? So that's why you have insurance things and you have, you know, disaster relief and all of that, right? Because in that particular instance, the lowest level isn't enough. You have to step up and get help from a broader group of people, right? So that makes sense to us, right? But the problem in operating out there is that in the long run, I think all of those social programs that are meant to be a safety net that become a way of life are simply going to fail or have already failed. Rather, again, we have to go back to, I think, the way our Western society was developed, which was, of course, the charitable gift of faithful people in the church. That's where our hospitals came from. That's where our schools came from and universities. So much of the time, it was some saint seeing a need and saying, I'm going to found a religious order so that we can help the ill who are poor. We can help young women who don't have an education, who are poor. And those have developed into, over the centuries, the greatest institutions in the world. So it all started, though, with eyeball-to-eyeball contact with people in need. And so I think that's key for us, is to really, when we see the needs of others, again, we may not be able to help them with everything, but chances are we can help them with something, even if it's just the dignity of knowing that people care about them. And to make sure that we are not insulating ourselves from the plights of others. And once again, I'll just reiterate that invitation to maybe get involved in something like the St. Vincent de Paul. Get involved in the Gabriel Project or any of the other things where we reach out to real people and with real needs. And I'll end with that great quote, which I've mentioned before, from Cardinal George whenever he was raising funds for the St. Vincent de Paul in Chicago, that he looked at these wealthy people who were donating and he was grateful, but he said, you know, the poor need you for their earthly needs, but you need them to get to heaven. And it's the same way with us, right? We can't wall ourselves off in our place of comfort, as Amos talks about, as Jesus talks about. But rather, allow ourselves to become uncomfortable for the sake of others. And in the process, we ourselves will find ourselves in the bosom of Abraham.